Thanks for pressing play, swimmers and swimmers. I'm Garrett McCaffrey, and joining us today, he was recently named the National Team High Performance Specialist for USA Swimming. He's Dr. Kirk Grand, and this is the Swim Swam Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to get into a whole bunch of reasons why you are a really good candidate for this job. But let's start out by asking, what made this job the right fit for you?
It's just always been a dream job. And I think that everything that I've done in my career up until this point kind of fills a box that I think that I can bring to this job, in sense of from a club level, I've coached 13-14 year olds to high school to college, and then I did a big stint at swim labs learning dartfish, teaching random people from learn to swim to Air Force, Special Forces, wanting to get different certifications. So it just kind of fit everything that I've done to this point, and it just kind of seemed like the next challenge. And it was always one of those jobs, if it ever opened, like always wanted to make a run for it. So that's kind of how the job got started, but thanks for having me on. It's always look forward to these podcasts and what everybody has to say.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to be interested in what you have to say. Let's talk just a little bit more about the role. And for example, you got your feet wet at the international team trials in Greensboro, North Carolina, a couple weeks ago. What does your role look like at a meet like that?
So for that meet, I worked directly with Matt Barbini, and he basically gave me some baby food. Just do the filming, upload the film, put it in the right file, name it the correct way. So just learning the language, learning how the organization at that, like the high performance team, operates, being a good teammate, filling in where people need me, mainly not getting in the way. That was my role. Got to do a little bit of looking at the race stats. So for those of you that don't know, a lot of the national team people, after a race, they'll get stats on their stroke count, stroke length, tempos, all that good stuff. And so kind of pairing that with the video was really, really cool for me to see the numbers, watch the swim, look at the video. So that was kind of mainly my international trials meet, just making things seamless for Matt and the rest of the staff. And then coming back from that, I was just recently out in the Springs, and it was kind of like compile the data. Now we got all this data. What do we do with it? How do we help coaches? What do we say? What coaches need this? What coaches need that? So really, it's a big service role. So from the meet, you get the raw data, and then you come back and refine it. And so that's kind of what happens at those large international trials meets. And this is from some of our juniors that are like Leah Hayes's, and you know, that are also making their name made on the big show, on the world's teams. They'll get different numbers, and introducing them to that, what's this mean? So it's kind of a teaching everything role. So it's exciting.
Is there anything, cause you're going to be working with the junior team as well as the national team, and I mean, pretty much all the coaches that are willing to listen in some way, shape, or form through USA Swimming. Is there something like with someone like Leah, who is at such a high level at such a young age, that you're surprised she doesn't keep track of already?
I think Leah's gift is she's just tough, and she's fun to watch. And when she turns to that freestyle and that 400 IM, like you better be ready, because she's coming, you know. And I think that's her gift. And I think just sort of having those conversations, it's just like coaching, right? You have these conversations, you ask them questions, and then you sort of meet them where they're at and nudge them along with different reference points, or different, hey, like, did you know you were doing this? Or can you see this? And obviously in today's world, visual aids are 100% better than me just communicating it to you in some random fashion that hopefully it sticks, that you just so happen to know that exact language. But tuning in to each individual, I think, is what I'm passionate about, and hopefully can kind of put a spin on this position and that aspect.
Yeah, that's specialization is, I think, a buzzword that a lot of coaches use a lot, because that is the goal. And the more specialized we can get with the individual athletes, the more successful each program works. But in order to kind of have some scope of where to look, you've got to see some trends. You've got to have some ideas of basic areas to look for, you know, places that they can improve. Through kind of analyzing the data from just international team trials, did you see any trends that were kind of common that might have surprised you? I know that it's counter to what you just said about individualization, but for us in our, you know, podcast time limits, we can't get into everybody's individual stuff. So trends are really important for coaches to be able to kind of get a big picture of things to look out for. Any trends that you saw?
Just from fresh eyes, I mean, backstroke tempos are like, you know, you got to be, for the men's side, you got to be like 0.9, 9.5, 9.7 if you want to be in contention in any of that stuff. Like, that was pretty telling. And obviously, you know, watching different people with different skill sets, like somebody might be a tempo swimmer, somebody might rip through an underwater or rip through the 15. And so what suits each individual is a part of it. However, everybody's at a good rate in the backstrokes, it seems like. The 150 especially, obviously the 200, you can, a little bit more variability within that. Breaststroke, it's the tale of two things, right? Like, so for example, Kate Douglas took 60 strokes in prelims. Like, to me, I was like, 60 strokes, long course 200 breaststroke, like, I felt like that was super impressive. And then she took 66 at night and goes 221. Like, however, the other side of the coin is Lily King, where she's taken 84-ish strokes, so 24 more. So it was kind of neat to see that. But when you see the 60 number, I saw the number first, and then I watched the race, and I was like, well, duh, her kick is – like, Tate's kick is incredible, right? Whereas Lily's a more pole-dominant breaststroker. So the tempos are funny. That's a trend that you can see going in different directions in different events. Breaststroke's always one of those. You try to find that balance. Because one thing that Eddie, I told Eddie this, I was like, hey, Kate took 60 strokes. What do you think? She's like, well, sometimes when you take that few of strokes, you're not breathing enough. And I was like, well, that's kind of an interesting perspective on that. But she seemed to figure it out okay. So different, and then you bring this stuff to coaches, and then you pick their brains, and then it changes your lens, and then you just kind of nudge along. And it was very stimulating, to say the least, from my perspective at the meet, watching it from that bird's eye view up in the stands in the nosebleeds, but it opens everything up. But I think those were the two things for me that I feel like were trending. Low stroke count in the breaststroke. If you can do that long course and ride or glide, that's impressive. And then the backstroke tempo, especially that 50, where it's just get out of your breakout and almost like spin drill down the pool. Yeah. That was wild. So,
yeah, I mean, everybody saw it. Just you could see it with Hunter Armstrong's tempo in that world record 50. For a guy that big to be able to be moving those arms that fast, you would think he'd be slipping through the water, but obviously catching a bunch of water.
So he just doesn't slow down. So I think that's his gift. Like, he figures out how to maintain and hold, and it's fun to watch.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. So I want to jump into some more of those trends, but I kind of want to take a step back and just talk about you and how you got into this position and all of your accolades that you've done up to this point. You've got your master's from the Councilman Center at Indiana. You got your PhD in psychophysiology from Auburn. Let's start from the Councilman Center and just explain what that experience is. I think obviously people recognize the name Councilman, and everybody knows one of the most legendary coaches in the sports history, Doc Councilman, who came from Indiana. But what happens when you get your master's from the Councilman Center? And I know you also spent some time working at the Councilman Center as the associate director, but take us through what happens with that education and how sports specific it really gets at the Councilman Center.
So the Councilman Center, when I was there, it was basically, again, nerding out on swimming. It was, what does the size of the paddle mean? We measure people's hand sizes. Does hand size correlate? Is it a surface area of the body type of thing? So you're answering all these, or you're trying to find answers to all these hypotheses that a bunch of people that have swam their whole life are sitting at a table and they're wondering, you know, about, you know. And when I was there, they installed the, it was an endless pool, but it was used more as a flume. And so that kind of fueled a whole different side of things, from water temperature, what that looks like, what is the highest temperature that you can swim in an open water context before you say, call it, like, we cannot have a meet today, it's too hot. So they did a lot of that stuff in the flume. And then they started doing, as I was leaving, they just started doing refining protocols for in-water VO2 max, which is, if anybody figures that out, that's the hardest thing to do with the breathing patterns and how, you know, swimming is so, it's so hard to find an ecologically valid number with in-water VO2. But they were getting started with that, so sort of how to measure some workload in the flume. A lot of power analysis. Prior to me being there, Josh White was at the Councilman Center as well. So it was kind of like he did some work on starts, and a lot of his work was like swimming safety, like helping USA Swimming with, this is the block recommendation height wise, this is the depth wise, and just doing some of the physics behind that. So really it was kind of an all encompassing, again, nerd out on the sport of swimming. And then the basic benchtop physiology behind it. So it was, you know, muscle biopsies, looking at glycogen stores, looking at flow volume loops, which is how the lungs work at different, you know, capacities and or altitudes. Dr. Steger, the person I worked under there, Dave Tanner, they're both direct descendants from Doc Councilman, which has been the coolest part for me. I feel like, you know, my uncle was a coach, was also a swimmer, and then, you know, just being around him and then being introduced to Steger and Dave Tanner, who Dave swam for Doc. So I felt like I was working with direct, like, this is like the pass down of, you know, the great Doc Councilman. And so that was the most impactful thing for me, and carrying the little things through. And I think regardless of the science and what Doc did, his biggest thing that I fell in love with was people first, athlete second. Like, if you coach the person, no matter what, I think, you can't lose. I mean, yes, they may set a world record, they may not, wherever they go in their life, like, that person you've coached is going to go on, and whether they go to med school or whatever they do, they're going to take that, that impactful moment of their lives, whether it's 4 years, 2 years, 1 year, and take that on versus, you know, everybody says it's cliche versus, oh, I won this medal, or, you know, I swam this fast. But this was a great experience. And so that was a big undertaking of learning about Doc, learning how he treated the swimmers. He had kids over all the time. Like, his wife, Marge, would cook for the kids. And it was just sort of this, I don't know, holistic swim place. And then they'd go and compete for jelly beans, which was so cool. Like, so he was an artist and a scientist. And that really intrigued me to look at. I really, really was interested in, yeah, the benchtop physiology was fine. You can measure lactate. I got super interested in the science of the art. So can we contextualize, can we write about this art side in a scientific way to help people have the highest probability of, you know, tackling this artistic side? Because, you know, for some people, they love that physiology, that, you know, that's their thing. But if they can get a little bit better at, you know, the charisma, the artistic delivery, how to make it sort of gamified. Like, and he was doing that back then with the science. He was filming different people, and he'd turn the lights out and put a little light on their finger, and then that would trace, and he would take a bunch of pictures, and it was cutting edge stuff, but the kids were all engaged in it. And so the engagement level that he was working with was insane. It was never just come in and like grind it out and it was a curious sort of dynamic learning environment. And that's something I've always taken with me from Doc. And it was just kind of like a laboratory, and he was all science at some point, but he was such a magician with the psychology of, you know, Mark Spitz, or a psychology of a bunch of elite males. And the closest thing to that, I mean, I think he's surpassed Doc in some, is Eddie Reese, right? Like, and I think they do a lot of the same sort of modalities and the way that they lead and coach.
Did you find some science of the magic, some things that you could really pinpoint? Because obviously you're taking away that relationship first mentality, which, I mean, I couldn't agree more with, and have learned over and over again throughout my coaching career as well. But are there any, like, any little bullet points or anything that you could kind of give us from what you found in your search to kind of put a science to that magic?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a couple things. The first one is language. Like, That's basically what I studied. The language of learning is what I studied at Auburn, going from sort of the basic physiology to the brain sciences and looking at electroencephalography, fMRI, and how performance under pressure affects the brain, how what you say in certain moments matters. And we've all heard stories about different coaches that know when to say it, what to say it, you know, and sort of giving yourself the highest probability to say something or don't say something in these specific moments. And there's a guy, I think he works with Irish rugby. His name is Dr. Winkleman. It's the language of motor learning, essentially. And so how can you communicate movement to where you're not boxing, like, so for breaststroke, for example, like, everybody's got a different breaststroke. So if I'm going to teach a breaststroke at an elite level, everybody's got to have a little bit of a different modification. So how do I speak that to an athlete in a way that elicits efficient movement, but also is very simple? Like, and I think that is the, that's the first thing, because what we found was if you change one word in a sentence, your brain response can be altered, right? So we'd have people in the fMRI and we'd say, like, this is a performance under pressure example, but we'd say, like, if you score 10 points on the next task, you will get $100. And so we had skin conductance, we had a heart rate monitor, and so you can see this elevated, the nervous system was like, oh, like they got nervous. And then you basically get one person would get one instruction and one person would get the other instruction. And it was the same length of sentence, the same amount of syllables. They just changed one word, and that one word can elicit a physiological response. And so, yeah, the language, I think we forget how powerful that can be sometimes. And I think if you look at, like, an Eddie Reese, he is a linguistic master, and everybody, he keeps it super simple, but he never gives you a closed answer on stuff. It's always sort of an open-ended, and that's the next part, where self-controlled feedback. If you give people a little bit of a sense of autonomy, they're making certain choices, ask them what they think, that ownership. And sometimes what I've experienced, you know, from 12-year-olds to 22-year-olds, you have people that don't like that. They want to be told what to do. But I also think that that's a balance, right? I think you have to sort of lead them to be able to make choices of what they need for their warm-up, what they want to do in terms of training event-wise, like, and so having those conversations and not giving them the full answer is a humongous part of, I know, the goal process, but I think sometimes goals can be too black and white, and it's more the daily interaction of, you know, it could be a 5-second on deck before they get in, like, hey, what do you think about this? I think Ed's good at giving the wittiness, and then when I was there, you know, I worked camp there in 2013 right after the center, and so it was kind of a cool watching from all the science and taking all that, and then watching Ed and Chris Kubik was still there at the time, and just how they work together. And Chris is even, I think Ed said, it's like, Chris is a genius of people, and you can see that. And like, they just had this dynamic duo going, and I know that Wyatt's taken that role, and he just kind of fills in where Chris kind of left off. And so it's that engagement. And like, I just watched, you know, some video, they were doing, oh, I think it was Herbie at Arizona State doing the Jack Sparrow walk to dive into the pool. But that's so Doc, that's so Ed, like the Foursquare, like the laughing, like that, just ease of engagement, allowing that, trusting your athletes. I think it all comes back to that, but how do we sort of, I don't want to say give a template, but give some protocols to sort of work through for coaches, maybe in that language aspect, to get a little bit further if they're uncomfortable with those sorts of conversations.
A lot of great points about how some of the best, not only today with this current generation, but even maybe councilmen decades ago, kind of differentiated themselves by giving the athlete a choice. It really just tell them what to do, but helping engage them in that process. Even from your scientific background, seems to be one of the keys to success, right?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we've mentioned some of the, you know, the greatest college coaches of all times, but, you know, even working at swim labs where you're working with a 5-year-old, 7-year-old, to high schoolers, just even teaching or getting them to show you some skills prior to putting a skill set on them. Like, oh, can you show me how you kick across the pool? How fast can you get there? And that's like at the most basic small level of the sport, and then teaching swimming to refining like where somebody's placing their hands. I think asking them questions and getting them to show you a little bit of what they do and how they do it, it's going to make you better at reaching them along the way. And I think at the highest levels you see, and you know, Eddie and Doc and Chris and those guys aren't the only people that do this at a high level. However, just the exposure I've had with them from the science and then watching them, and obviously, you know, 15 national titles isn't too bad. But yeah, that engagement is super huge. And there's a humongous amount of research that not only motor learning research, but just how people learn research behind essentially empowering people. And I think when you can empower somebody, you just can't lose.
Is that the degree, the essence of your PhD from Auburn? Psychophysiology is not necessarily something everybody understands. Is that essentially kind of what you studied?
Yeah, so we studied just learning and how people learn, and then just the movement is way more complex than you think. I mean, just reaching down and grabbing your cup of coffee or holding the cup of coffee balanced and walking into the other room, like, we take it for granted. I mean, robots are getting to a point now where they're getting a little bit better, but it's such a complicated system that we, you know, just use every day. So what I studied was the interaction of the mind and the body. And so that's primarily what we looked at. Like, how can we get the mind to, I don't want to say turn off, but a lot of elite performance was with a quiet mind. There's not a whole lot firing that doesn't need to be firing. It's just the essential patterns that are going. So like when you're swimming 100 or Michael Jordan's thinking about a free throw, he's not thinking about his technique. He's thinking about one thing. He's going to swish the back of the net. And so that's different for everybody. But we studied performance under pressure. We studied how people come in and just learn a new skill. We studied pretty much anything and everything in terms of just reward-based learning, fear-based learning, just learning in general. And I was able to, since I was sort of the first like PhD student to go through with my advisor, Dr. Matt Miller, I was kind of able to write the book on what I wanted to take. So I took a lot of cognitive science classes in the psych department. I took a judgment and decision-making class, and then kind of formulate my dissertation, which was essentially, does a non-essential choice, like the color of a golf ball, if you're going to putt-putt, if you give somebody a choice of the color of their ball, does that elicit enhanced motor learning, and does that retain, can you retain it, and then can you transfer it? So I think the thing that we have to think about as coaches is retention. Like, can they come into the practice the next day and do the drill you taught? Yes, that's easy. It should be easy. But does doing that drill transfer to when they're on the block in a relay, anchoring? Is that where you're going to make your money? Like, and when we teach skills and drills, we have to make them matter or else they don't matter. Because the transfer point, when you're going to a meet, do you see it at the meet? I think that's how we have to kind of work backwards from in terms of skill. But when you can engage kids and get them to think about a skill in a new way, it's going to stick at a really high level. And so that's kind of the stuff that I studied at Auburn, and it was a broad spectrum. But we found that if you give a person a choice of a golf ball color, they tend to learn the skill at a higher level. So it's just a fascinating thing. And it's like, do you want paddles or no paddles? Or do you want fins or no fins? And like, we get in these fights with equipment, which is fine. But like, ultimately, if they're going to engage 1% more by wearing a fin or putting a paddle on or not having a paddle on, that should be okay. I mean, and there's certain things we have to set the tone and set your boundaries, and that's all healthy too. But in the big scheme of things, I think those small little choices, or letting them have an incidental choice that really isn't going to make a difference. Like, they didn't wear paddles for, you know, 10 100s. Is that going to be like the game changer in your week that you periodize for, you know, like, I don't think so. And so I think it's going to make them feel better. They're going to learn a little bit better because you're working with them, you know?
Yeah. there seems to be a path, a strategy that is pretty easily accessible, at least for coaches, whether you're going to clinics, whether you're listening to hopefully podcasts like this. You can find formulas that other coaches use that work for physiology, but the way that you implement it can't really be, you know, conveyed in a conversation, unfortunately, like this in 45 minutes or so. Can we talk about what you think maybe some of the misconceptions of that given system are? Like, here's one that I'm coming across a lot. Like, I read these books on periodization, and they talk about having, you know, aerobic days and anaerobic days and really complementing some of the most intense work with true aerobic work. And Ulbrich's aerobic work in a lot of people's workouts looks easy, and coaches sometimes have trouble with that. So can you help us understand what exactly is aerobic work by your definition, and how much of it do we really need to be doing?
I think, you know, that's a great question. I think humans are taxonomous, and we're going to try to, you know, pare this down until it's in nice little meat boxes. And, you know, the reality is the body doesn't work that way. It's all interplaying all the time. Aerobic to me is, we are aerobic animals. If you think about it this way, most of us that take care of ourselves and are fit, we should be able to finish a marathon. We might not run it the whole way, but we are endurance aerobically inclined athletes, or, you know, humans are, like Homo sapiens. Whereas there's only a few of us that can go under 10 in a 100 meter sprint. Like, that's just very, very difficult. And that's sort of a genetic feat. And just the way that people are wired are just different. So aerobic is a very healthy thing. Like, but you can be aerobically fit, you know, from walking to jogging. But aerobic to me is just, it can be easy cardiovascularly, but it should be challenging in the sense of it should be pretty. Like, you shouldn't do ugly aerobic work. I mean, at that point, you're working against yourself. Yes, you're checking this physiological box, but you're taking away from this skill box that's humongously important. And so teaching people how to flow and move through the water should be your primary number one thing. Like, if you get better technique, you're generally going to get better swimmers. Like, if you can get a miler to do a little bit better streamline off every wall, I promise you'll drop time. And no amount of like aerobic threshold that will work. But again, there's going to be this limiting factor at some point. So it depends on the point in the season. You know, aerobic in beginning of the season and end of the season look kind of similar to me. Longer rest, you're looking for a heart rate, you're just swimming smooth, you're feeling your kickouts. Aerobic in the middle of the season, you can go on tighter rest. But again, it's all how you evolve your season. And I'm not big into super technical, you know, periodized seasons. However, like, you should know when you're going to be good, and you should know when you're going to be training really hard and you're going to swim really slow. You know, that helps you from a training aspect, and that helps you from an expectation aspect as a coach. And you know, like, you know they're tired, so you're not expecting like to go to this meet and light it up, because just where you're in training. I think that regardless of what you do, I think what you see with a lot of people, the people that have systems, whether they're perfect or imperfect, once you have a system that allows you to sort of play with this charisma or autonomy and learning based side of things, and you hear stories about Urbanchek and all these people, like, they're sort of these larger than life people. They have a system, but then their this personality is, whoa, like, I'm energized, I want to swim, or even like a Durian on deck, like, just intense and just, you know. So whatever your system is, be a scientist with that. And like, I think science these days is kind of an interesting, you know, that's a different topic, but it's a matter of observe, ask a question, collect data, see, and like, don't let your, you know, a lot of coaches, the problem with coaches today is it's confirmation bias. If you see something that you know it worked, and you think you know why it worked, chances are, like, we're humans, there's about a million variables, you know, and so we think that Susie missed this practice on Tuesday morning, and that just threw, like, and sometimes it's so we get so technical and X's and O's that we have to take a step back and be a little bit more scientific. And what you're watching behavior of the athletes, you're assessing fatigue, and then you're writing a program. But once you have a system, then you can sort of modify the system. But I was talking with Bernardino at ACC's, and we were talking about coming off or going back to training after ACC's. And basically, you know, you hear Bernardino, like this guy who's just like the grinder, and he's like, don't go back too fast. Like, make it very gradual. And that's kind of how I think about training. Like, if you're jagging up and down, that is not going to be good. It's got to be smooth. So whether you're going up or coming down, it's just got to be flowy and smooth, just like you would want like a good dolphin kick to look like, I guess, like just very smooth and efficient. I think that's the most important thing when you're making a plan. Like, you don't want to change a whole lot of what you're doing quickly throughout a season. So as long as you have a plan and you're smooth with it and you trust it, I think that that's the basics of periodization. Like, now you can adjust on the fly, but I think that having a plan set out at the beginning of the season is super helpful. You pick some meets and you work backwards. I think that's always better than sort of shooting from the hip. I know. And like, you're always going to shoot from the hip in a given practice, no doubt. But like, when you just kind of show up and you decide what you're doing on a week by week basis or every 3 weeks basis, that can be challenging, especially for, you know, beginners that are fresh to a team. Like, you don't know the kids you're working with, or, I don't know, maybe a new stimulus was introduced, a new strength coach was introduced. And so you just got to watch. And again, like, talk to them, listen to them, and then watch how they move in the water. Like, there's so much information there that I think, in your analogy, it's just like cooking. And I know there's chefs and bakers, but if you pay attention to what they're doing and how they're moving and are they smiling, and you'll know when you can press them a little bit or back off a little bit. But pick some meats and work backwards and look at the skills and try not to go based on times. I know that's hard for people. Look at skill sets, like qualitative assessments versus just quantitative assessments, I think are huge. And I think that's the part of the sport that I'm interested in, is like, okay, we have all this qualitative data. I would love to learn what you were thinking about on this third 50 to get this tempo. Like, tell me more about your race strategy in your mind, and then having a qualitative sort of section that you can save and then give these athletes on the national team or junior national team. Oh, like, when you thought about this, this was really, really good for you. Or when you thought about this, or you knew your mind got away from you, like, I think that'll be a helpful supplement. And that's just my first idea, and how I can help the most is just getting like a sort of a race synopsis after they race. So
I don't want to break down your job into just, you know, finding these general trends and watching people look out for it. But with your background, not only scientific background, but also just all the coaches that you've worked with, and just your ability to watch the sport through a very unique perspective. You talked about, you know, making the system smooth and not jagged and up and down. But then where do we get into trouble with overtraining then?
I think so. Overtraining is tough because, I mean, I guess it's not tough. You have to come back to cooking, right? Like, sometimes if you're looking, you ain't cooking. Like, you've got to be able to trust. And like, I think the more you develop a relationship with the athletes and the people you're working with, the more comfortable they're going to be able to come to tell you that they feel like they're broken down, and you'll be able to watch how they walk in. And like, the places that I've been, like in IU and even North Carolina and Auburn, like you have the kids that come in and they don't say anything and they work hard and they're just there. And like, when those kids start, like, those are your barometers, right? You're going to have some people that complain every day. They want to get out of the set. There are some people that work probably too hard. Like, you have to put some constraints on them. Like, hey, like, you got to make it to Saturday. Here's the idea of this set. And then you have people sort of in the middle that, you know, are infrequent in their effort, or they give it sometimes and not all the time. And so individualistically, you kind of go down the pool and you kind of look at, okay, well, this person's presenting, he said he's not sleeping, he's got finals coming up or whatever. and he is training like absolute. Maybe he just needs a few days off. And I think, yes, there is a feel component to taking days off when you need it that you do kind of lose. However, you don't lose any, like, that is a aerobic background and those some of those enzymes that you gain, you don't lose those quickly. Like, unless you're just, like, tied in your bed and your bed rest for 4 or 5 weeks, like, they're, you're, these are Ferraris, right? Like, they're so elite that it's they don't lose them very quickly. So overtraining, like, I think it's a natural state. You always want more as coaches. Like, you want to push, you want to see how far people can go, and they want to see how far they can go too. But I think it's just, again, collecting your qualitative data, your quantitative data, and writing it down, looking where you're at in your training, and then getting their background. Like, have a conversation with, hey, where have you come from? Have you come from, you know, like an 8,000 a day club with mornings, or did you come from a 2,000 a day you've never lifted and now you're in a 20-hour a week program? Like, it's the writing's pretty on the wall there. Like, and I think that, again, that comes back to the gradual flow of their training. Like, you have to do a longitudinal assessment of that athlete and the person as well to see where they're at, both athletically and personally. So if they're graduating as a senior and then all of a sudden you're just cranking that heat up as a freshman in college, like, you can lose a lot of freshmen that way. And so it just, you have to kind of, I know this is a challenge for a lot of coaches, but I don't want to say it's individualized, but it is. I mean, you can have the same set, but a lot of different iterations, you know, and you can have people not come to mornings and come to afternoons. Like, how you frame it and how you construct it is, again, like, that's the system that you need to decide for people. But I think coming back to trusting that people want to be good and they will give you all their effort, you know, they're showing up. I mean, we all have problem, you know, athletes, and, you know, I wouldn't say problems. We always have those athletes that make you so much better and challenge you to be better and find new ways to engage them. But I think in general, most people want to come in and be good and they're going to work hard. And I think understanding from working from that, be a trusting person, don't be a not trusting person. And I think that helps you find those kids sooner. But I mean, you know, there's a lot of coaches, especially the old school coaches, where you see it too late. You know, you can't say, we had some breaststrokers this year that I was really worried that we were not going to be able to save, because breaststroke, especially for the guys, is such a taxing, powerful stroke. And they were swimming too much breaststroke for, you know, we were about 6 weeks out. And so we didn't swim any breaststroke, just a reserve, you know. But be vigilant and don't be afraid to make an adjustment early. And there's certain times when you can really amp it up. And but again, I think coming back to know the person you're working with and be flowy with the training, like, be smooth.
Yeah. I came into this interview with a lot of scientific, you know, questions that maybe we would have more definite answers to, but I'm hearing you loud and clear about just the mentality of each individual is so unique that it really impacts everybody's training and the actual, you know, data and the definite answers that we're looking for. There's one thing that I think you alluded to a couple times there in that answer that I really do want to ask about, though. Why is our sport such that if you're out for a few days, you lose that feel component? Like, what is that about our sport that makes it so hard, and what makes it so scary for coaches to give a couple days off or stay away from breaststroke for a week or something like that? That feel for the water, it seems to be such a unique element to our sport. Can you shed any light on why in that?
For sure. And so I do want to get back to the science of what we're talking about, but I think proprioception, right? Like, it's a sport of you're diving in and all your proprioceptors in your skin are being stimulated at once. And you're going through this flow of the water. And like, that is sort of, you know, humans, the density of air is, water's like one and the air is like 0.0. So it's very not fluid to be on land, right? Like, we're terrestrial creatures. As soon as you get in an aquatic environment, you know, your system is, you know, that's, and so sort of that feel, you can lose a little bit of it, but you don't, I think it's just sort of the status quo. It's just been handed down. But like, for example, a story about my uncle, he was a sprinter at Texas in the 80s, like back when training was very different than it is now. And he came in and he was just broken down. And this kind of comes back to our overtraining question. And Eddie's like, it was like a Friday. And Ed was like, Chris, I'll see you next Friday. Like, take a whole week off. Like, and at that point, Chris, who like swam for a different coach prior, who was just grind volume, he was like, Raph said he couldn't believe it, right? And I think most people, you hear 7 days off, like, again, what you're refreshing is the mental side. Not that off is the answer. Sometimes it can be different things. You can come in and be engaged on deck and do some dry land. And like, but like at this particular time, just being away from the pool was best for him. You come in refreshed, your nervous system gets a little recharged, you're going to eat better, you're going to put a little bit more muscle on. You're just going to be fitter and better and stronger, and your body's going to be ready to rock and roll.
All right, so Kirk, I heard your answer, and I definitely understand the human element to things, but I also know, and I know that you believe that the physiological side of the sport is huge, or else, you know, you wouldn't have spent all the years you did with all the educational things that you've done. But in your experience, how would you explain something that you touched on in that just that last answer about the feel for the water? Because I don't know if that's actually a physiological thing that we have in our sport or a psychological thing that we have in our sport. But if you've been out for a few days, it takes a couple practices to really get your feel back for the water. And if you've been out for a couple weeks, you definitely feel like spaghetti arms when you first get back into the water. So, I mean, what is that feel and why do we lose it so quickly?
Feel for the water is the epitome of the psychophysiology, right? The mind and the body. And sometimes our mind runs and, you know, you make more of what that should feel like when you come back than it really is. Or the other way is, you know, you come back and it actually is happening and you just kind of work through it and understand that it's going to feel crummy for a couple of days or a couple of sessions. But I find that that's coming back to that aerobic question. Like, if you can just swim light aerobic, you'll get your feel back really quickly and don't make it any crazy, you know, off the blocks or anything like that in terms of coming back from a break. I don't have the exact answer. It's different for different people. Some people can take time off and come right back and they're right snappy in it. And some people, you know, their brain is trained to say that, wow, like I feel horrible. And if chances are, if you're coming in already worried about how you're going to feel, I mean, that it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy that will play out to feel noodly and you won't feel very good. And so in many ways, is if you can frame it as a coach and sort of, you know, when you make something a big deal, it's going to be a big deal. But if you can kind of work through it and minimize some of that stuff and just say, hey, just feel it out. What do you think you need to do today to feel good? And I think the feel thing, yeah, you can go off on a tangent and say, you know, what is the feel? It feels an emotion and all that stuff. Well, the reality is, again, they're human. They're not robots. And ultimately, you're trying to figure out what training that person absorbs and how they absorb it. And so hopefully, based on your data and all that stuff that you've got for that person, you'll know what to work and prescribe when they come back. But I think it can be sensationalized a little bit, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. And I'm going to tell my swimmers that too. So, hey, I appreciate your time. This has been a great conversation to really kind of dive into some of the science and some of the psychology that goes into swimming. My last question is for you here, just into this new role as the National Team High Performance Specialist. And I imagine that we could talk again in a year or so if you've been in this role, and it might change, your answer might change, but if you could present to USA Swimming coaches, you know, at the club and collegiate level, looking towards high level performance and elite performance, and present on one topic and give us a tiny glimpse into what, you know, you would say about it and why, what would that presentation look like?
I think it would come back to, you know, that people first, athlete second. Like, I think that'd be a great title for a talk. I think knowing physiology gives you that platform to be able to be creative with the training, but also knowing the people you're coaching and interacting on the human side gets you so much further in a skill set standpoint, and then it works the physiology as well. So I guess it's sort of like a holistic style of coaching. Swimming, I mean, you can walk up and down the deck and engage with your kids. But I think, you know, people first, athletes second. You can go a lot of different ways with a talk like that, from personalities to behavior to the nuts and bolts of physiology. But the more you learn about the physiology, trying to get too trapped in it, put, you know, Wayne Goldsmith, and this is a, we can end on this, is that his famous quote is to put physiology last. But you need to put it first in terms of, you know, you need to know how the engine works before you can sort of have an assessment of what the engine's doing. And so I think that having that framework allows you to sort of create, and knowing the overtraining, knowing who's training at a high level, and just gives you some vantage points to work from versus going in blind with no physiological background. So,
well, Kirk, this seems like a great fit for you. And although, you know, I think the deck will miss you as a coach, and, you know, being able to work with one team, I'm sure is something that you'll always treasure and look back fondly on. I think you get to reach a lot of athletes and a lot of coaches this way. So I'm excited to see you in this new role, and I feel like USA Swimming did a great job filling this role. And I, you know, really excited to watch where it goes with you.
I'm just excited to serve in the best way I can and be what everybody needs me to be.
Awesome. Thanks for your time today.
Appreciate it, man.
You've been listening to the Swim Swam Podcast. Stay tuned for new episodes every week. You can take Swim Swam Podcast on the go by subscribing on your favorite podcast platform. Look for links in the description below, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more videos as well.